Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Mon nom est Martin Craven-Cross et je suis le directeur du développement durable ici à l'Université McGill. Il me fait grand plaisir de vous accueillir ici ce soir pour ce qui promet d'être une soirée inspirante et excitante avec plein d'énergie et plein d'idées qui débordent de la salle. Avec la lutte contre les changements climatiques, les hausses importantes dans les prix du pétrole et le bouleversement associé à l'exploitation des hydrocarbures non traditionnels, la question de l'énergie est à l'avant-plan du débat de nos jours. On peut s'attendre à ce que ceci demeure le fait pour bien des années à venir encore. The timing of this event could not be better. In about an hour, engaged Quebec citizens, NGOs, and CSOs will be convening at the Delta Hotel in Quebec City to provide their perspective on the energy futures for Quebec in the context of a consultation being hosted by La Commission sur les enjeux énergétiques du Québec. This consultation is part of a series of consultations being held this fall to inform the development of a new energy policy for Quebec expected in 2014. As one of the leading universities in Quebec and Canada, McGill takes its responsibility to society and to the environment very seriously. I'm proud to be able to stand here tonight and report that since 2002, McGill has managed to reduce the carbon or the CO2 emissions related to its facilities, to its utilities, by 30%, by a whopping 30%. And that is, in large part, thanks to the energy and dedication of our university services team. Juro. But we're also acutely aware of the fact that our biggest contribution to society comes not from the way we manage our buildings, but from the new knowledge that we help emerge, the new norms that we foster, and the way we act as an institution. And with this in mind, I must share with you the fact that having Suncor as the main sponsor to the event tonight has not gone without critique and debate here on campus. In its mildest form, the critique goes, how can we have an open and critical debate in a situation where the main sponsor for the event is so heavily invested in the exploitation of the Alberta tar sands? To this, I will answer that we here at McGill have a responsibility to foster a balanced and critical debate. What better place to succeed at that than here? And this is exactly what we have strived to achieve in collaboration with our partners at the Walrus in designing the programming for tonight's event. In its more extreme form, the critique asks, how will we manage the risks of legitimizing society's dependence, unsustainable dependence, on use of fossil fuels in the climate of, in a carbon-constrained environment? To this, I answer that we strongly believe in the leadership that can and that must come from industry. We note with great interest the fact that Suncor is in the process of developing post-2015 objectives on sustainability. We are excited by the ambitions of companies such as Denmark's Dong Energy, who have adopted the target of reducing their relative CO2 emissions by 60% by 2020, while doubling their exploitation of petroleum and natural gas. The McGill community looks forward to seeing how the inspiring and innovative ideas that emanate from the event tonight and other similar events will be taken up by Suncor's and the energy sector more broadly. I'd like to thank Suncor for making tonight possible, and I'd also like to thank our friends and collaborators at the Walrus for their efforts in making tonight happen. Finally, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the fact that McGill is located on traditional Haudenosaunee territory, and I'd like to thank them for the opportunity to live and learn here tonight. Thank you very much. Mesdames et messieurs, bonne soirée.
Thank you, Martin, and thank you everyone at McGill for having us. I'm Shelley Ambrose. I'm the Executive Director of the Walrus Foundation and the publisher of the Walrus Magazine, which is the longest title of anybody, unless you're an academic. They have longer titles. We are grateful to TISED, the Trottier Institute for Sustainability in Engineering and Design. And Mr. Trottier seems to me to have been, is a very forward-thinking person to have established this with a $10 million gift. That's a wonderful thing, and we're very happy to be here. We're also grateful to the Office of Sustainability for hosting us in this beautiful but very warm, we apologize, air conditioning broken theater. We're going to keep the doors open, and I hope that that will keep you, and promise that the drinks will be cold afterwards. I also want to thank our presenting sponsor, Suncor, who is, as if you don't know, you will see, as dedicated as we at the Walrus are to providing forums for constructive conversation about a sustainable energy future for Canada. If you don't know us, the Walrus Foundation is a national charitable nonprofit with an educational mandate. This is the pointy-headed, serious part, to create forums for conversations on matters vital to Canadians. One forum that we create is the Walrus Magazine. And the Walrus Magazine is celebrating its 10th anniversary this very week, and this is our 10th anniversary issue. There are other issues outside that I want you to help yourself to. So we create the Walrus Magazine, and when you open it, you'll find stories and debates on all kinds of topics: politics, culture, the environment, business, technology, foreign affairs. The Walrus has no wings, and we are an independent entity with no owners and no one point of view. The idea of the Walrus is that we don't end conversations in the magazine or in forums like this. We begin them, and we really assume that our audience is smart enough to go out and figure out what it is that they think. These Walrus Talks events, this is part of a national series this year in Victoria, Vancouver, Calgary, Toronto, Ottawa, other places. And we're covering topics from the Walrus Talks conversation to the Walrus Talks experimentation. We're also philanthropy, sustainability, performance, and energy. And how do we arrive at our topics? Well, I said our mandate is to create forums for conversations vital to Canadians, vital to all of us. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a more pertinent topic than our relationship with energy. We also have to understand that we believe that we need to have conversations about energy in terms we can all understand. And to do that, we need to achieve some kind of energy literacy, because creating a vision for our future is very challenging and complicated, and so educating ourselves is necessary. Tonight's event, Suncor presents the Walrus Talks Energy, is one of four energy talks we're hosting across the country over the next 2 years. The talks are live streamed at thewalrus.ca and will also be available for viewing on Walrus TV. As well, in keeping with our shared goal of keeping the conversations we start here with you tonight going, you can visit walrus.ca and see our discussion group on energy. You can also sign up for OSCAR, which is the oil sand question and answer blog and newsletter that Suncor, very forward-thinking, started about 2 years ago. And you can ask anything there. And the conversation information will be given, and there's a back and forth, and it's actually very constructive. They do weekly posts answering all kinds of questions. And, of course, we know that there's a conversation happening on social media. If Twitter is your preferred modus operandi, the hashtag for this event is Walrus Talks. Now, here is how the Walrus Talks works. Each of our esteemed speakers has exactly 7 minutes. Each will come on stage and introduce him or herself. There is no MC. When I leave, I am gone forever. If you want to know more about them, please refer to the program in your hand. Each 7-minute talk will act as a standalone segment, and so speakers will not refer, however brilliant, to the speaker before them, nor will they introduce the speaker coming after them. You will hear the 8 of them in a row, and our hope is that an hour from now, we'll all have a lot to think about and even more to talk about at the post-talks reception and out there in the world. Our real goal for the Walrus Talks is that everyone leaves thinking, I never thought about it that way. Just before I let them get underway, I'd like to thank them in advance. We're very grateful to them. We know that every one of their talks will be like a little pearl, and by the end of the night, you'll have a necklace. Don't you love that? So thank you to the University of Calgary's David Lazell, Peter Calamai, the Globe and Mail's Sophie Cousineau, Queen's University and Walrus contributor, Brian Purchase, Philippe Dunsky, Zhejian Mi, Chris Henderson, Student Energy's Kaylee Taylor, and the person who will wrap us up is the Vice President of Business Services and our Walrus Talk sponsor, Eric Axford, and you'll meet him at the end from Suncor. Thank you all for coming. Let us begin.
My name is David Lazell, and I want to talk to you today about Canadian energy systems. In the developing world, our energy systems have fueled a very high quality of life, delivering luxuries that would be the envy of virtually all previous generations. These systems have also brought with them some unintended consequences, including air pollution, water contamination, and climate change. The global scale of the climate change issue and its frightening environmental and economic implications has focused attention on our need to transform our energy systems and dramatically reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that are the byproducts of fossil fuel combustion. This diagram represents the energy systems of Canada in 2010. In it, the thickness of each of the lines is proportional to the amount of energy that is actually flowing through that part of the system. On the left, we have the primary sources of energy that are made available in Canada or imported from abroad. Canadian energy industries recover and process these energy sources into crude oil or into energy commodities that include gasoline and diesel fuel, electricity and ethanol. These energy commodities are either exported or used to meet the domestic demand for energy services. Now, Canada is among very unusual among developed nations of the world in that we are a major energy exporter. We send more than 50% of the primary energy that we extract from nature to other countries, primarily the United States. Today, I want to talk to you about our domestic energy systems. I'm going to simplify this diagram by removing the exports and the imports and focus only on the energy flows that are used to meet our domestic demand for energy services. As in the previous diagram, Canada's energy industries convert the primary sources of energy into energy commodities to meet the domestic demand for non-energy uses such as plastics or paints and other materials that use both oil and gas. For mobility, for personal mobility, and actually our supply chain, our movement of goods around, we use primarily oil. Almost 100% of the energy input is from oil. Our residences, where we live, as well as the buildings that we have, our commercial and institutional buildings across Canada, are reliant on gas and electricity, not so much on oil. And then our non-energy industries, including mining, manufacturing, etc., tap into all the sources of energy that are part of Canada's energy system. So where do the energy-based greenhouse gas emissions arise within this system? As you can see here, they're associated with the places where energy is converted, either into different forms of energy, as I've talked about before within the energy industry, the white areas, the white bars, or into energy services on the right-hand side. What I want you to note is that about two-thirds of the domestic emissions in Canada from our energy system, or 336 million tons per year, take place where we consume the energy commodities to fill service demands. Power generation and the recovery and processing of oil and gas make up most of the remaining 33%. So as a society, we need to decide how best to transform our domestic energy systems to dramatically reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, even by as much as 65 to 80%. Achieving this transition will not be simple, and many argue that we don't really yet have all of the necessary technologies. However, this kind of systems-level perspective that I'm showing here makes it possible to identify some high-level features of an energy system transformation that are needed if we are going to address the concerns about climate change. And I have three of these items on my list in the remaining couple minutes. The first is to recognize the very important role that electricity must play in the future clean energy systems. Electricity is the only energy commodity, the major energy commodity we have, that does not produce an emission at its end point of use. So it's ideal for use in meeting distributed energy demand. However, we first must eliminate the fossil fuel emissions associated with power generation and replace it with some of Canada's vast hydro, wind, solar, biomass, and nuclear resources. We also need to expand capacity of our electrical systems with additional clean energy to achieve major emission reductions, both on the demand side of our energy system and on the supply side. And indeed, if the yellow arrow going back showing electricity flow to our supply side, some of the most promising transformative technologies for reducing emissions from oil and gas production require large supplies of low or zero carbon electricity. The second key element for energy system transformation involves technology and social innovation. There is much that can be done to enhance conversion efficiency or to deliver the services we demand with less energy or at least fewer, lower emissions. Transforming urban design is imperative since cities are where most of the majority of the demand emissions occur on the right-hand side of the diagram. What we need are energy systems technologies that not only reduce the environmental footprint, but are less expensive and more convenient. We need for energy what digital technologies did for the music, photography, movie, and book sectors in the past 20 years. So that's our key element number two. The final key element number three is about the resources that will make this happen. And to finance this transformation, we certainly need a price for carbon. But I personally don't think this will be enough. We are fortunate in Canada to have a second option, to couple the economic benefits of fossil fuel energy and export to the transformation of our domestic energy systems. We know that the lack of access to global markets is depressing oil and gas production in North America. What if we were to link the public license for companies to extract and export Canada's energy resources to activities within Canada that will make us the global leader in the transformation to sustainable domestic energy systems? Our vast resources are in an energy-hungry world offer us this opportunity. Thank you.
My name is Peter Calamai, and I am a recovering journalist. I'm going to talk about energy conundrums. Some people may have seen the spectacular exhibit of veiled Chihuly glass at the Musée des Beaux-Arts in Montreal. And if you did, perhaps you thought for a moment about the energy that was consumed in creating those phantasmagorical shapes. The energy of the furnace that melted the glass, the energy of the lungs that blew the glass, the energy of the arms that twisted the molten glass. Yet, in fact, no energy was consumed to create that entire exhibit. No one, in fact, consumes energy. Equally, no one produces energy. That's what the first law of thermodynamics says, the law of the conservation of energy. The total energy consumption of the world is zero. What happens is that energy is converted from one form to another, and almost invariably the net quality of the energy decreases in that conversion. Highly organized energy becomes less organized and, to our way of thinking, less useful. So the energy represented in concentrated form as the gasoline in your car is converted into heat and exhaust gases, into friction between the tires and the road, and into the kinetic energy of your car's movement. When most people talk about energy production, energy consumption, energy efficiency, and indeed about energy policy, they are really talking about the carriers of energy. And that means predominantly electricity and fuels like oil, coal, and natural gas. We produce and consume these energy carriers, and in so doing, we use energy. Now, insisting on this distinction isn't mere journalistic quibbling. Using the catch-all phrase energy policy smears all the different energy carriers together and lures us into a mentality of thinking that they are interchangeable. But they aren't. You can't realistically run your computer directly on natural gas or your car on coal. As noted by Walt Patterson, who is a Canadian-born energy guru living in Britain, what's essential here is infrastructure. By that, most people mean things like refineries and power stations, which we can call energy supply infrastructure. But Patterson means more particularly buildings and lamps and motors and electronics and all those technologies that deliver what we want from energy. So let's call that the energy service infrastructure. And here we come to the first of my conundrums. There's an awful lot of both kinds of infrastructure in advanced societies like Canada, and much of it displays dynamic inertia, meaning that it strongly resists change. At the level of individuals, consider the meager inroads of the R2000 house or high-efficiency gas furnaces. At the national level, look at the tremendous existing investment in pipelines, fossil fuel-fired power plants, transmission and distribution lines, the tar sands, and so on. Any significant changes to both these infrastructure systems is going to be measured in decades. Now, unfortunately, as a nation, we have shown neither the intellectual insight nor the government's commitment towards charting a path to a national policy for sustainable use of fuel and electricity. Here is a 1979 report from the Science Council of Canada, which recommended $4 billion of R&D demonstration projects to move the country towards energy self-reliance. In hindsight, a few of the proposed projects were bang on, but the Council's conclusions and recommendations included no mention of tar sands, no mention of wind energy, and no mention of photovoltaics, 1979. This brings me to a second conundrum. 3 decades ago, we at least had a science council with well-qualified staff directed by some of the nation's preeminent scientists and business leaders. The council set its own agenda and gave its advice publicly. There is nothing like that in the federal system today. Yet such a credible, arm's-length science advice agency is essential for the process of coming to public judgment on sustainable energy use. It's going to be extraordinarily challenging to have a meaningful public dialogue about sustainable energy use. One reason for this difficulty is that many in Canada, in common with other Western democracies, don't trust their governments to be truthful or transparent, or indeed don't trust many of the existing institutions. Any such national conversation must overcome another deep-rooted obstacle, which might be considered a third conundrum. Most Canadians are in a state of denial about our country's profligate use of energy. We are the third most extravagant OECD country in per capita energy use. More telling, however, is how far we are from the various inspirational goals for sustainable energy use. A study led by the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology proposed the equivalent of using 2,000 watts per person per year. Canada is currently 5 times that. Why are we? Earlier I mentioned the poor uptake of R2000 housing and high-efficiency gas furnaces. Most people simply can't be bothered to make such changes, often because any payback isn't within their personal time frames, and more fundamentally, because they don't accept that our existing consumption of fuels and electricity can't continue. The good news is that it's possible to change public attitudes on such matters. Many years ago, I served on an advisory committee to Environment Canada. We commissioned a study of how that most unlikely coalition of tree huggers and duck hunters made acid rain a top-of-mind issue for average Canadians. It turns out they did so by applying the lessons from social science research. So if I were drawing up a roadmap for a sustainable energy future for Canada, I'd start by enrolling the best minds from the social sciences to help shape that essential national dialogue. I'd then shame governments to lead the way by upgrading the public infrastructure across the entire country. Imagine every publicly owned building from office towers to prisons as a model of energy efficiency. And finally, I'd remind policymakers that the history of science strongly suggests that the advances needed for a sustained energy future in Canada will most probably come from curiosity-driven research and not from the targeted, directed R&D that is now the mantra. People like our current governing federal party are disdainful of letting scientists explore what they consider useless questions. In the mid-19th century, one such useless question was why things change color as they heat up. The answer led to quantum mechanics, and from there to transistors and to semiconductors. Some of the solutions to our energy conundrums will probably be found by researchers also exploring such useless questions. Thank you very much.
Bonsoir. Je m'appelle Sophie Cousineau, and I am Global Mail's chief Quebec correspondent. The Walrus Foundation asked me to address you both in French and in English. Alors, à la Montréalaise, je vais passer d'une langue à l'autre. But if you need, if you have any questions, I'll be here afterwards so you can grab me. I must profess my remarks with this caution. I am not a scientist, I am not a scholar, and I really don't pretend to be an expert either in energy or in the environment. In fact, I'm a little out of my league tonight when I look at tonight's speakers. But I have been following the energy debates for some time. And from the simple observer's standpoint, it's quite apparent, as it was said in introduction, that the political climate, both in Quebec and in Ottawa, is burning hot. Both Ottawa and Quebec have grand, albeit contrasting ambitions. Canada hopes to export its crude oil that is enclaved in Alberta through a network of new pipelines, and the most controversial of which is, of course, Keystone XL. Quebec aims to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 20% by 2020, and that's just 7 years from now. To reach this goal, the province wants to electrify its means of transportation, and it wants to reduce its dependency on oil imports, which account for 60% of the province's $21 billion trade deficit. And efficiency is not the only way it is looking into. Quebec has some big oil ambitions of its own. En Gaspésie, sur l'île d'Anticosti, dans le Golfe Saint-Laurent. Those projects have pitted environmentalists, local interests, economic developers, promoters, companies, and they have become so polarized and partisan in nature that they now resemble Congress budget debates. The willingness to compromise is about is non-existent, almost. C'est un dialogue de sourds, and it is a future exercise as a consensus building. It didn't used to be that way, at least not in Quebec. Lorsque l'ancien premier ministre Robert Bourassa a décidé d'ériger des grands barrages dans la région de la baie James pour dompter la grande rivière, qu'on connaît maintenant sous le nom de LG, dans les années 70 et 80, les Québécois se sont ralliés derrière ce qu'on appelait à l'époque le projet du siècle qui devait créer 100 000 emplois. Le Québec rêvait de prospérité avec son énergie propre, and prosperity was not seen as a dirty word. Beaucoup d'eau a coulé depuis ce temps-là, à l'évidence. We now know many things now that we didn't know then, and we are wiser for it. Environmental groups are now working hard to slow down the global warming by reducing our carbon footprint. And it has been a frustrating battle, as our attention has turned to other causes. These groups have gotten, in the meantime, though, much more savvy at countering the big energy companies and their countless lobbyists. C'est bonne guerre, comme on dit en français. But with this constant opposition, our society is not necessarily better off. Les citoyens sont confrontés à des études contradictoires, à des faits qui sont détournés à des fins partisanes assez régulièrement. Alors, qui pourrait les blâmer d'être confus, d'être méfiants envers à la fois les promoteurs, à la fois les gouvernements et à la fois aussi envers les groupes environnementaux? Dans un monde idéal, ce serait au gouvernement de faire les arbitrages, de trouver des solutions qui sont peut-être imparfaites, mais qui réussissent en quelque sorte à concilier, dans la mesure du possible, la prospérité puis l'environnement, parce que c'est la base même du développement durable. Unfortunately, our governments have agendas of their own, and when it comes to deciding between competing interests, their own political objectives taint their decisions. It's quite a contrast if you look at Ottawa and Quebec. While the Conservatives want to speed up the environmental approval processes as if it was an end in and of itself, the Parti québécois is asking for ever more consultations, studies, and imposing moratoriums. Le jupon dépasse, comme disent familièrement les Québécois. You would hope that economic logic, plain coherence, would prevail over small-time politics. Unfortunately, ce n'est pas ce qu'on voit. Les décisions gouvernementales sont empreintes de considérations qui sont tout à fait contradictoires. Prenons seulement ces quelques exemples du Québec. It's quite, I mean, wind power is green, but why should the Quebec government be ordering more wind power from the Gaspésie region when it is swarming in surpluses? And the only reason why is it doing that is to maintain manufacturing jobs in a remote region where they're hard to come by. Reversing the Line 9B pipeline, as Enbridge wants to do, so that it could flow east, which was its original direction, this will protect Quebec's two last refineries and the petrochemical ecosystem in the Montreal East. The economic benefits would outweigh the risks from an environmental standpoint. And until we get rid of oil, then we still need to transform it to use it locally instead of importing it from Northern Africa. If fracking is found to be scientifically unsafe to extract gas, then why would the Quebec government consider it to extract oil out of the Anticosti Island just for the sake of energy self-sufficiency? Also, it's a fine idea to electrify our transportation systems, but this is a costly long-term project. And before we get to that, there are a couple of things that we could do that would be easier and much quicker to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by converting trucks to gas. I know it's still a fossil fuel, but transportation accounts for 43% of Quebec's greenhouse gas emissions, and this is something that can be done right now. For the governments to achieve their goals, Quebecers and Canadians will obviously, in the end, need to change their habits, and there's no better way to do this than with pricing. It is neutral. Quebec needs to increase, there was a mention of huge energy consumption and waste. Quebec has been maintaining the price of electricity at an artificially low level for decades. That, more than anything, would reduce all of the waste that the Quebecers have gone accustomed to, and incidentally would also help Quebec to balance its books. And Canada needs to put a price on carbon. That's also a non-brainer. Be it a carbon tax or a cap-and-trade system, only then we'll be able to make the right choices. Merci.
Good evening. My name is Brian Purchase. We live in a society with one overriding consensus political objective, economic growth, which I define as an increase in our ability to alter our environment to suit our needs and our tastes. We pursue this objective using both tools and energy. Tools direct energy to its greatest effect, but it is energy that does the work. Without energy, tools are useless. And we experienced that, of course, in the ice storm of 1999 in eastern Ontario and Quebec. And, of course, again in 2003 when 50 million people in north central North America were without electricity. So, and of course, humans cannot live without food, which is simply energy fit for human consumption. Accordingly, there is probably no more important price in our society than the price of energy. As in the case of all other commodities, the market price of energy reflects its scarcity. Abundant energy relative to our requirements means low prices. That's good for economic growth. After World War II, low energy prices supported strong, sustained economic growth in the West. To paraphrase John F. Kennedy, the economic growth of that era was a rising tide that lifts all boats. However, when energy becomes scarce and prices spike, it has a profoundly negative impact. Indeed, spiking energy prices have changed the fundamental structure of our economy and society in the last 40 years. When energy prices spiked in 1973 and then again in 1979-80, productivity growth in the industrialized West fell off a cliff. Stagflation, combined high inflation and high unemployment, became the norm. Manufacturing jobs disappeared by the hundreds of thousands. Middle-class status became elusive, especially for the less educated. Two-income families became commonplace, and economic growth shifted to Asia, a low-cost energy regime based on coal, the lowest-priced fossil fuel. Spiking energy and food prices also fundamentally altered economic policy in the West. Monetary policy became focused on controlling domestic wage growth, precipitating a deep recession in 1980-82. To restore productivity growth, deregulation, free trade, and globalization of the economy were embraced. Taxes on investment and dividend income were cut. Sales and payroll taxes falling disproportionately on the poor were raised. As a result, then, of global market forces and these policy changes, the rich grew profoundly richer, and their fortunes were essentially delinked from their neighbors in the same country and city. Economic growth was no longer a rising tide that raised all boats. Household debt grew steadily. In 2008-2009, spiking energy prices pricked the subprime mortgage bubble and precipitated the near meltdown of the global economy. We live still with high unemployment, very high levels of household and government debt, and an addiction to cheap money flooding stock markets. As might be expected then, high-priced energy is particularly a disaster for the poor. As with a nation's real GDP, a household's real income is simply a measure of its members' command over their environment. To be poor is quite literally to be powerless. And increasingly, the poor are at the mercy of global market forces. Oil prices are determined in global energy markets, not local ones. Geopolitical instability, especially in the area of the Persian Gulf, regularly sends shockwaves through the global economy on the international transmission mechanism of spiking oil prices. And thanks to the bonanza of shale gas, North America could soon join the global market in natural gas as an exporter of liquefied natural gas. Accordingly, natural gas prices could soon become a similar transmission system of global instability. The price of energy is a cost to some, it is at the same time an income to others. In an energy-rich nation such as Canada, this matters. Political interference with the price of energy necessarily involves interfering with the regional distribution of income. Regions with abundant energy resources clearly gain from high energy prices. In Canada's Federation, this causes profound problems for national economic and fiscal policy. Resource rents, mostly under the control of the provinces, are not equalized across the country. Some provinces, such as in Quebec, rich in hydroelectric energy, choose to keep their electricity prices below market value for resident customers. Others, such as Alberta and Saskatchewan, rich in fossil energy, are able to fund generous public services, even while keeping taxes low. These policies distort the national economy and federal-provincial fiscal relations, but our federal government is largely powerless. Politics shows up as well in the underpricing of fossil energy. Fossil fuels provide over 80% of the world's primary energy, and these fuels are responsible for over 80% of the emissions of carbon dioxide, the primary contributor to man-made global warming and climate change. Given current technologies, fossil fuels are overused because they're underpriced. In most places, their market prices do not include the cost of their degrading impact on the local air, water, and soil quality, or their global impact on the warming of the planet and climate change. Indeed, their use is even subsidized by many governments around the world to the tune of about $500 billion annually. What is the right price of energy? It is one that reflects its full social cost, as well as, obviously, its full social benefits. And if one wishes a society in which the poor are as empowered as the rich, it is also a very low and stable price. Given our current technologies, that may seem implausible, but it is far from impossible. My vision of our energy future is one in which all households have at their fingertips, and virtually free, all the environmentally benign energy they need to fulfill their basic needs while freeing their imaginations and intellects to soar. Thank you.
My name is Philippe Dunsky, and I'm here to talk about finding efficiency. Although, as I was on my way here, I thought that a better title might have been finding the missing half, the missing 50% half of our nation's energy resources. To explain why I'm talking about the missing half, I'm going to use a single chart. If you bear with me, it's not the easiest of charts, but it'll hopefully make my point. And that chart is the chart of Canada's energy flows. If you look at this chart and you look on the left-hand side, you'll see essentially our production of energy resources, as well as some imports. You'll see up top we produce an awful lot of uranium, a fair bit of gas and oil as well. We also produce a reasonable amount of hydropower and coal, and you'll see a very thin sliver, a little thin green sliver, that is the sum of our non-hydro renewable resources, all of the biomass and wind and solar put together. That side of the nation's energy flows is obviously hugely important, and at the very same time, not at all of interest for me today. What's of interest for me today is the rest of the system. Now, when we look in the middle of the chart, what you'll see is how that energy flows into the system to its various clients. And by clients, I mean you have electric power plants up on top, and then you have essentially three sectors of consumption as those circles over to the right. The top one is homes and businesses. The second one is industry. The third one is transportation. Those are the clients for our energy. That's where our energy flows to. And again, we spend an awful lot of time debating and discussing the merits of how energy should flow to those different sectors and whether we should bring in certain types of energy or other types of energy to each of those sectors. Again, not the focus of my interest tonight. My interest, and frankly, my pet peeve, and the thing that I've been working on for over 20 years now, is actually to the right of those clients. And if you look at this chart again, you'll see that to the right of each of those clients are really only two colors. The yellow streams is the sum of all of the energy that is actually used, that actually serves a purpose. That's the sum of all of the energy that goes to lighting, that goes to mobility, that goes to heating and cooling our homes and businesses, and helping our industries operate. That part I'm interested in. The part that I'm far more interested in still is the other half. 47% of our entire energy system goes to absolute waste. 47% of every single ounce of energy that comes into our system serves a total of zero value. And in fact, as we all know, it's a little bit worse than zero value because that waste energy then transforms into heat that transforms into greenhouse gas emissions. This is what keeps me awake at night and has for some time. And this is the one big resource, waste energy, that frankly is as big as all of the rest of the energy system combined, that I think we need to be spending an awful lot more time focusing on. The good news is that there's an awful lot that can be done. In fact, there's an awful lot that has been done already. If I look at the past 40 years, had we not improved the efficiency of our use of energy, we would have had to build four times as many power plants as we did. We would have had to dig four times as many or drill four times as much oil and gas as we have. So we've been improving efficiency, just not at the pace that we need to going forward. The other good news is we are doing more and more as time goes on. About 10 years ago, in North America, we were spending about $1.5 billion a year trying to get at that top resource, energy waste, and dwindling it down and getting more efficient. Today, we're upwards of $10 billion a year being poured into the effort to reduce waste and improve energy efficiency. That's growth. That's a good direction. But there's still an awful lot more to do. I'll end it there as the one idea that I'd like everyone here to keep in mind. The greatest energy resource that we have in this country, as throughout much of the world, is improved energy efficiency or energy waste. Thank you very much.
Good evening, my name is Tianmi. I will talk about lighting the way. Shown here is the nighttime view image of North America, and you may identify the Montreal-Toronto area in this image. So one may wonder how much energy lighting consumes. Astonishingly, general lighting consumes more than 20% of global electricity, or over 10% of the total energy produced. Today, in commercial buildings, lighting accounts for nearly 30% of the energy consumption and is one of the most inefficient energy conversion processes. Today, making lighting more efficient and reducing lighting-related energy consumption represents one of the most important challenges we face. And yet today, we are using the 100-year-old lighting technology in Cadison Labs, which were first developed in the 19th century. While you may think Thomas Edison was the inventor for this technology, Henry Woodward, a medical student in Toronto, actually invented a nitrogen-filled light bulb in 1874, which was the best lamp at that time. But Henry could not get financing for his work. This Canadian patent was subsequently bought by Thomas Edison for commercialization for only $5,000. Such incandescent lamps are very inefficient, less than 20 lumens per watt, with over 90% of the electricity converted to heat. Fluorescent lighting is more efficient, in the range of 50 to 90 lumens per watt. But it contains mercury, which creates serious environmental issues. Today, LED lighting has been identified as the best lighting technology on the market based on its reduced environmental impact. Unlike conventional lighting technologies, wherein the efficiency is inherently low, LED lighting can, in principle, be 20 times more efficient than incandescent lighting and 5 times more efficient than fluorescent lighting. It has been forecasted by the U.S. Department of Energy that LED lighting can drastically reduce the energy consumption. At the same time, LED lighting can reduce the operation cost. So the replacement of light bulbs represent a non-negligible cost of this operation. For LED products, the lifetime ratings can reach well over 100,000 hours. This will significantly reduce the maintenance cost associated with the replacement of light bulbs. As an example, for a child born in Canada today, to the time that he or she goes to college, more than 20 million lumen hours of lighting will be consumed. This is equivalent to the use of more than 20 incandescent lamps, or three compact fluorescence lamps which contain mercury. However, for LED lighting, only one lamp is required. Based on the forecast of the U.S. Department of Energy, LED lighting has the potential to reduce energy consumption due to lighting by 50%. By 2020, LED lighting will account for more than 30% of lumen hour sales of the general illumination market. This number will grow to be over 70% by 2030. With the rapid market penetration of LED lighting, the energy savings is enormous. The cumulative energy saving in U.S. alone will reach 2,700 terawatt hours in the next 20 years, which represents $250 billion based on today's energy prices. This will lead to an effective reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by nearly 1.8 billion metric tons of carbon. The growing demand of LED lighting will create significant economic and environmental impacts, as well as enormous commercial potentials. It has been projected the market for LED lighting will reach over $15 billion by 2017, 4 years from now. This estimate does not include light fixtures, accessories, and the design, installation, and maintenance costs, but only the value of light bulbs. In contrast, employment in the traditional electrical lighting industries in Canada has experienced a severe decline in the last decade, with an annual decrease of 6.8%. In 2010, the rate of decrease was 11.3%. The emerging LED lighting will provide the extraordinary opportunity for Canada to reverse this declining trend in the manufacturing sector. The U.S. Department of Energy has identified LED lighting not only as a solution to reduce energy consumption, but also as a window of opportunity to provide new economic activity. Today, LED lighting is well beyond the replacement diagram. LED lighting can mimic natural lighting in various settings. It can provide a more comfortable atmosphere at home, in your work, or and on the street. It can also provide a much more comfortable atmosphere during your travels. LED lighting can optimize the learning environment for the next generation of Canadians to have the best possible start in life. Such new technology developments are taking place in many fields, including solar cells, artificial photosynthesis, and communications, and are rapidly changing the landscape of our lives. Thank you.
Good evening. On the archive, my name is Chris Henderson. I'm the president of Lumos Energy, and I act as clean energy advisor to First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities from coast to coast to coast across this vast and magnificent land. And I'm also the author of a recent book called Aboriginal Power, which is why I'm here to speak to you today. On the walls of the Archives of Ontario is this magnificent cartographic image. It's a map of David Thompson, explorer extraordinaire, who worked for the Northwest Company and traversed around across Canada. This map is an image about the resources that we have in this country, renewable resources, wind, hydro, solar, biomass, and geothermal, that we can tap into and there is a demand for. And that demand will be satisfied only if First Nations, Métis, and Inuit communities in this country share in the bounty of the renewable resources on their traditional territory. And they should. Of the 100 poorest communities in the country, 92 are Aboriginal. It is a sad Canadian story of a history that is not consistent with our Canadian values. It's a story that we have to change. We have to write a new history of Canada's relationship with its First Peoples, and I submit to you today that perhaps one of the most effective ways to do that is through clean energy development that helps protect our environment and regenerate our economy. It's April 22, 2010. I'm in the community of Inukjuak in northern Quebec. It's Earth Day. Inukjuak is on the shores of Hudson's Bay, the eastern shore near the Arctic Circle. It's an Inuit community of 2,000 people, pristine, lovely, and it's reliant on dirty diesel power for its heat and power. The Inukjuak River, which flows beside the community, is a source of hydropower. And this is an example of the clean energy resources that can feed Aboriginal communities, but ones also on the grid that can feed the consumption of energy we have in this building, in your homes, and in our industries today. I would submit to you that if we don't do that, we miss perhaps the greatest single opportunity to change the energy mix that you've seen already today to one that is more sustainable for the future. The Inukjuak River flows pristinely. We'll put a small reservoir on it without a dam, with a large dam. It will fuel and take away the diesel fuel that now litters the land and emits harmful greenhouse gas emissions. For anyone from Quebec, from Hydro-Quebec or the government, if you want to know about Inukjuak, talk to me after. So you might say, that's Inukjuak. What about other communities? What's amazing is that we have gone to 0 to 80 in the last decade in Aboriginal clean energy across this country. In every province and territory, there are Aboriginal communities with own parts of clean energy projects on their traditional territory. Projects that not only supply cleaner power for us, but also are economic value generators for themselves. And they go on and on. You go to the Lower Mattagami in Northern Ontario, Big Beaver Falls in the Kapuskasing area, Doki Wind in Northern BC, La Romaine in North Shore of Quebec, Frida Creek near Powell River in BC, Mbata Falls near Thunder Bay, Okie-Kendot on the French River in Northern Ontario. There are questions about how these projects are developed in a clean, green, and sustainable way. An Aboriginal part talks about that, how they're doing just that. Because if Aboriginal people are co-owners in the livelihoods of sustainable resources, they will take the stewardship that their generations and elders have given them to make sure it's generated and used wisely and the environment, habitat, and fisheries protected. So you strike the balance between economic need for energy with cleaner power with the need to protect our environment. Aboriginal power is nothing else than a story about heroes, and I have many. Let me tell you about a few. Chief Judith Sayers is the former chief of the Hoopakasset First Nation in Port Alberni, at the end of Barkley Sound, looking at the western verge of the Pacific Ocean, a beautiful area. They found a small run-of-river hydro project called China Creek. They developed it 10 years ago. It's now fully paid for. It generates about $500,000 of revenue for their band every year. Revenue channeled into health and social services, into education, and into economic development, building a sustainable prosperity platform for that community. And there are 80 to 140 communities doing that across the country today. Over half are built, half yet to be built, and well on their way. It is a story of regenerating Canada and regenerating our energy future. This picture of the three headdresses of the Painan project, Shikasta patient James Smith and Peter Chapman First Nation. In 171 years after they were pushed together by the Government of Canada in one reserve, they have never, even though they've intermarried and played baseball together, they have never done anything economically together in almost two centuries until today, when they're developing a hydro project called the Paynan Project on the Saskatchewan River. So clean energy is not just a forger of a regeneration between Canada and its First Peoples, but among First Peoples as well. This is the picture of the French River, a beautiful river in northern Ontario, connecting the Ottawa River watershed with the Great Lakes, part of what Étienne Brûlé and Samuel de Champlain connected to found Canada. It's also the home of the Ojibwe people, the Dokis people. Dams were built there 100 years ago by the government of Canada, and nothing was done ever with them. Now, the Dokis people started construction 2 months ago on a small 10-megawatt hydro project with a partner that they own 40% of. That 40% over the next 40 years will make that community $50 million. That'll change their community and give Ontario green power. Such is the power of Aboriginal power. I love Chief Denise Rastoul dearly. She's holding the staff, the eagle staff of her people, the Migasi, the fish eagle. And this defines a sustainable future that reflects on the past in a sustainable way into the future. My chief foreign plan is that the Sioux First Nation on Vancouver Island wanted to go through a sustainable development process with his community. They studied it for 2 years before they did anything. But then they said, we can do this to solar power. So they put solar power on this building, and they put solar power on every building in the community. 50 buildings across the community that are generated with solar power that is now changing the complete energy mix of the community, employing those gentlemen who happen to be on a cookhouse shack, which dries the salmon that is beautiful to eat. Sustainable economic development, sustainable community development, sustainable clean energy is the fundamental premise of Aboriginal clean energy and power, and that's what Aboriginal communities are doing, and you need to know that, and you need to embrace that. Peter Kirby is in the Atlin, from Atlin, the Tracker River Tlingit First Nation. They want to do a small hydro project to replace diesel power in their community up near the Yukon border. Peter tells a story about he started working part-time, then full-time, then the evenings, then the weekends. Then he started dreaming about the project. Then he had nightmares. But the project's done. It's replaced all the diesel power in their community, and his headdress adorns the front of Aboriginal power. Finally, my friend Shauna Morgan. She's a Cree. She now lives in the West, in Manitoba. Behind her is a picture of a teepee. Beside it is her grandfather. Shauna comes from two heritages, two DNAs, Aboriginal and white. And she says she looks at the world with two DNAs, and that is the story of Aboriginal power, the forging the partnerships between Aboriginal peoples, development companies, utilities, governments, and finance companies that benefit our economy, create jobs for First Nations, create employment for First Nations, create the economic generation that truly is sustainable. Ladies and gentlemen, what this does, what Aboriginal power does, it creates a clean energy capital circle, fueling the changing the future of Aboriginal people in this country. Remember, I said 80 to 140 projects now underway. That's one out of every five to one out of every six Aboriginal communities in this country. That's not a small amount. The total investment there is over $40 billion. The total megawatts generated will be between 11,000 and 14,000, about a third of Ontario's power. What this defines is this. When white explorers first came to this country, they were given these fabrics. It's the Turo wampum. The Turo wampum in Eastern Aboriginal traditions is a symbol of two canoes rowing beside each other, together into the future. For the last 300 years, we have disrespected that tradition. We have an opportunity into the future to not only respect that tradition, but affirm it, regenerate it through clean, renewable energy. And what that will do, in the mind of this Inukshuak, it points the way forward. It is this innovation, this ingenuity that we need to carve a new clean energy future for Canada. Because the Aurora Borealis may inspire you, it certainly does me. And the beautiful lichens of the Arctic represent the fragility of our environment, but also the potential of regeneration. Aboriginal power does that. I'd be pleased to talk to you after. We have books available for purchase. And what I would say to you, it's about energy. It's not about 50 Shades of Grey. It's not about erotica. But we all know the best orgasms are in the mind. This will tempt your mind and your heart. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kaylee Taylor, and I'm very excited to be here tonight. I always love participating in the Walrus Talks because I hold a unique position of being a Canadian who runs a global not-for-profit. So I get to remind all of us that even though we're Canadian and we have our Canadian values, what we do here has massive impacts across the globe, and we always have to remember that. So in preparing for my talk tonight, I decided that I had one goal, and that was to leave you all with a deeper understanding and appreciation for why we're even talking about energy in the first place. Now, you might think that sounds pretty obvious, but it's human nature to skip to symptoms before even looking at the causes. And I think that's so often what we do in energy. In all my years of working in the energy industry, I've realized that most people don't actually care about energy. You all obviously do to some degree because you're here, but in general, most people don't. And the reason for that is because society doesn't actually place enough emphasis on how important it is until things get contentious or controversial. We skip straight to debating whether renewables or hydrocarbons are the best source, or whether the approval of a pipeline is worth it, without even thinking about why energy is desirable in the first place. By definition, energy is the ability to do work, but we often forget that that ability to do work has allowed us as human beings to unleash our creativity and flourish. The trap that I believe we've gotten into is the failure to see this link and instead to see energy as an end rather than a means to an end. Instead of recognizing that energy is a mechanism that allows us to have comfort and productivity and a variety of other things that keep us happy and safe, we fixate on energy as the endpoint in itself. This, I believe, is the reason why sometimes we're willing to compromise the health of our planet and people in order to produce it. Energy has become easy. When we flick a light switch on, the light comes up. When we're cold, we turn up the thermostat and the room gets warmer. When we are out of gas, we can go around the corner to a service station. Very few of us actually ever think about the complexity of the systems that are behind those easy interfaces and allow all of this to happen. And even fewer of us think about the economic and social implications of those systems. And still, fewer of us recognize that that's indeed a luxury, and that there's still a billion people on the planet without access to electricity, and what we experience is fully luxury. Our fixation on energy as an end in itself leads us to miss the point. We don't want to produce oil to have barrels of oil. We produce oil because we want freedom of mobility. We don't produce electricity because we want electricity. We produce it because it allows us to educate ourselves and to communicate. One example is solar lighting in the developing world. Is everything okay? Okay. It's energy in the developing world. Solar lanterns are not valuable because they're a piece of plastic and some wires. They're valuable because they allow young children to stay up later and study at night. They're valuable because they allow farmers to check their fields without being bit by a snake. Do you see what I'm getting at? We don't actually care about energy. We care about what it enables us to do. And I believe this is a huge opportunity for us to change the entire discourse around energy and the environment. The discourse has become so highly polarized and highly emotional. But what if we could shift the conversation and take it away from us versus them, environment versus economy, or industrialists versus environmentalists, and instead focus on the way that we as human beings can reach all the things that we want in an efficient way and by using less? What if we could talk about the human side of energy and recognize the actual reasons that we strive for it in the first place? In 2011, the world's population passed 7 billion people. With that tremendous growth, energy demands are growing, and the Earth's capacity to sustain this is quickly shrinking. Put quite simply, our current energy infrastructure does not have the capacity to satisfy the energy appetite within the bounds of our environment's capabilities. One thing is clear, business as usual will not do and cannot be the path forward. There are so many technology and policy options, but if we use the same thinking that got us in this mess, it's not going to be a way to get out of it. It's time to abandon the status quo and get serious about the energy challenges that we tackle. Now more than ever, the clock is ticking, and we need action. I believe it is fundamental that we start humanizing energy and making it relevant to people. The reason for this is that if we're going to get creative solutions, we need those who are affected by those solutions to be in the conversation, and they won't be unless they're informed. Today's world leaders may be setting the 2030 and 2050 emissions targets, but it doesn't take long to do the math and realize that it will be my generation who's in charge of meeting them. We need to be brought to the table now because it's our responsibility and it's our future. We all have the responsibility to the generations who will inherit the planet after us, and we choose the legacy that will lead. I believe that if we can look at energy more holistically, as a means rather than an end, we'll be able to take the first step in this transformation. I guarantee you one thing, this is not going to be easy. Striking the balance between energy and environment is precocious and is going to be very difficult. It's going to require commitment and vision, creativity, positivity, pragmatism, and collaboration. But I have seen glimmers of hope in the current system, and I've seen the magnitude of change that can come from the next system. I'm up for the challenge. Are you?
Good evening. I'm Eric Oxford. I'm with Suncor Energy, and it's been a real pleasure to listen to the debate tonight and the various diversity of viewpoints. I think a few things I've kind of taken away and thought about as we've listened to this diversity of speakers is the open, transparent nature of this debate that is so vital to us as Canadians. Suncor is Canada's largest energy company, and you can be sure we want to be an active, vigorous part of this debate right across the country, a debate that actually brings together economic, social, and environmental leadership and prosperity because, as you've heard, the actual energy system is a complex, integrated one where much of the impact is actually driven by consumer behavior as well as the full value chain and producer behavior, but it actually is up to us as Canadians to actually make choices about energy and make efficient, effective choices. At Suncor, we like to think of energy as an opportunity, not as a threat. This country has an amazing opportunity for social prosperity, environmental leadership, and economic wealth, unlike many others in the world. Science, technology, and innovation is a big part of the story. That is a common theme to any discussion about energy, and we do need institutions, policy, and proactive action to actually ensure we drive the right science, technology, and innovation. Policy must stay up with the actual innovation going on in both social, science, and technology areas as well, and we've been a laggard at times in this country and need to regain policy leadership. What I'd like to challenge people to think about is energy as a verb, not just energy as a noun, but we try to think of energy as a verb and think about what action all of us are actually driving to make for a better country, a better world, and have a better outcomes from our energy system. I would just like to thank McGill University for hosting us tonight. Suncor was very proud to also sponsor this and would also like to thank the Walrus Foundation for convening these leadership discussions across the country. You heard mention of OSCR, which stands for the Oil Sands Question and Response blog. There's a lot of heated debate in the country about the role of oil sands in particular as part of the energy system. At Suncor, we believe engaging in that dialogue and really seeking to understand people's ideas and views is the most important thing to actually progress that conversation. So we encourage a lot of open debate through OSCR. You can see the blog sites on the screens behind me here. I would also like to just invite everybody to join the speakers for a reception up in the lobby here behind the theater where you can actually ask them some questions and pursue some ideas that you may have come up with tonight. And I think to the original challenge we had about leaving this room, thinking about one or two nuggets you took out of the conversation to really think about, oh, I never thought of energy in that way. And now you can go have a drink and some social time with people and explore that question further. So on behalf of Suncor, of the Walrus, and of everyone here, I thank you for your attendance tonight, and we will see you in the reception to follow.